Thank you for downloading this podcast, one of a number of podcasts recorded as part of the Leverhulme Trust-funded project, The Political Work of Richard Brinsley Sheridan, based in the School of English at the University of Leeds. Sheridan was a prominent politician, playwright and theatre owner during the reign of George III. This interdisciplinary project, begun on the 200th anniversary of his death, aims to raise public and academic awareness of the breadth and significance of his political legacy. In this podcast, we hear a speech given to the House of Commons by Sheridan on the 20th of April, 1798. The speech, which responds to fears of French invasion, calls for a united response to a common enemy. Sheridan manages to seize the language of patriotism without forsaking his liberal principles or surrendering his dislike of the government. The speech would prove to be one of Sheridan's most celebrated. His words were widely reported, with many newspapers printing his speech in full. The version you are about to hear was published in Felix Farley's Bristol Journal on the 28th of April, 1798, and is the version Coleridge would have read as he composed his Fears in Solitude. It is read by Professor David Farrer of the School of English at the University of Leeds.
I trust, sir, that it will be impossible for any man who views the situation of the country at this moment to conceive that I rise to oppose any part of the present address. Undoubtedly, if I had been present on a former occasion, when a right honourable and learned gentleman brought in his bill for the better defence of the country, though I might have accepted to particular passages, I should certainly have given it my most cordial and zealous support. And in doing so, I beg to have it understood that in the main points of it, I do not consider it as having conferred any new powers upon the Crown. Sir, I trust there is no one who does not know that in cases of peril, out of the ordinary course and contemplation of the law, the King is armed with full powers to call out the whole energy of his kingdom. In domestic outrages, this is in the power of a common constable. Undoubtedly, then, it is not supposed by the Constitution that in the danger and apprehension of a foreign invasion, the King is to be a mere looker-on. In that respect, therefore, I think that whatever service any man may give, he will do no more than he is bound by his allegiance to do. But what I wish superadded to this is to see a superior zeal to animate the country, a zeal which it is not in the power of any minister to call forth. Sir, in times like these, a common spirit will not do. And when I say that I wish to see a superior spirit animate the country, I rejoice to say that I do see it rising. Yet at the same time, I must also say that there is a sort of supineness and apathy which I hope and trust this House will remove. All society is interested in the subject of an invasion. It is a topic of universal conversation and curiosity. But really, there are those who consider it as a strange phenomenon which they may wonder at, but which they have no business with. They seem to wait for it as a show, rather than dread it as a peril. And, sir, this does not proceed from disaffection or disloyalty, from want of goodwill or from attachment to the enemy, but from their not being sufficiently awake to the real danger which surrounds us. Sir, with regard to this apathy and supineness, I have not the slightest idea but that immediately, upon the appearance of real danger, it would disappear. But there is much in previous preparation, not merely as to discipline and defence, but in the prompt avowal of the determination of the country. Sir, I have no doubt that the first drop of British blood that shall be shed by Frenchmen on British ground will raise such a spirit of valorous fury as must be invincible and irresistible. But, gentlemen, have not sufficiently calculated what the effects would be of any successful impression of French force upon the country. Sir, without retracting any one opinion which I have ever held, I do not conceive that there ever was any period in our history in which the conquest of the kingdom by a foreign power would bring such total ruin upon it as the conquest of Great Britain by the present French Republic. And when I say this, I do not retract anything I have ever maintained upon the French Revolution or the establishment of a republic in France. Sir, though deprecating the calamities to which the republic has given rise, I never wished the restoration of monarchy in France. I am not rejoicing that France has attained such power that she arrived at it by the coalition of the powers of Europe against her, and that if she had been suffered to remain as she was, she would not have attained that power. But I am saying that the impression of French force now would be more fatal than at any former period of our history. Yet, when I assert that I still hold my opinions, perhaps the right honourable gentleman may not think this observation well placed, but I do think that if the unfortunate person who may be entitled to the crown of France were, from a general spirit of loyalty in the country and by a restoration as little expected as our own in the time of Charles II, to be raised to the throne, and the emigrants who had suffered most by the revolution were to be called back, I say I do not believe that it would abate one atom from the ambition of France, or induce her to give back one particle of her power. I do not believe that her councils, though composed of persons who had been most encouraged and protected in other countries, would relinquish one conquest achieved by the Republic, would give up one inch of the boundary of the Rhine, withdraw one man from Italy, abandon an acre of the Low Countries, or above all, depart from the principle of doing everything to wrest the sovereignty of the seas from Great Britain. Though I dread the Republic of France, I should not dread less the monarchy of France. And in speaking of the Republic, I beg not to be understood as a person mixing in that spirit of invective and personality which has been adopted, and which I must express my regret at seeing continued in a clause of a bill which has passed lately. Sir, when we have been asking for peace with the government of France, I do not think it wise to charge them with cruelty, injustice, and oppression. Equally, too, should I reprobate any idea of animating the country by the coarse expressions of monster hush and ruffian general, which have been imputed to a person in high situation in another country. Sir, instead of resorting to such expressions, I would, on the contrary, pay the French a solid and sincere compliment. And I will tell you what that compliment should be. Knowing what they have done, and judging what they are capable of, I would omit no one human preparation that might enable us to make a successful resistance to the utmost their daring could attempt. That is the compliment I would pay them. That is the way I would meet them. It is not in any mortal power to say they shall not subdue us, but at least we may take care that they will not despise us. Sir, if I were to allude to Buonaparte, I would not recur to such invective. I would neither call him a monster nor a ruffian. He is certainly a great man, and if he takes the command of the expedition against this country, he will not tarnish his laurels by deserving those epithets. But I would at least distrust his professions. Right restored, freedom regained, peace to commerce, peace to cottages. He will come for the humane and liberal purpose of establishing liberty. Can anything be more glorious? I'd almost said more godlike than this. But is there any Englishman so absurd, so besotted and befooled as to give credit to one word of it? But may not republics be actuated by great and generous sentiments? Undoubtedly, they may. But I must first look to the nature and constitution of those republics. In the early and virtuous times of Rome, they did conquer for glory and to restore to people their rights. In the Spartan Republic, too, I can conceive the same, and that they might conquer for fame, and not for the acquisition of those luxuries which they considered as inimical to the republican spirit. But let gentlemen look to the constitution and practice of the Republic of France. Do they not see that their tree of liberty is planted in the garden of monarchy and that it bears the same luxuriant fruit? Are they not eager for all the luxuries and refinements to make their capital the school and mart of elegance for the world? What do they want? Glory? They are gorged with it. Territory? They have more, perhaps, than they will be able to retain. What is it they want? Ships, commerce, manufactures, cash, capital, and credit. Or, in other words, they only want the sinews, bones, marrow, and heart's blood of Great Britain. Give them that, and they will give you as much liberty in return as you please. They call you a nation of merchants. Well, they style you so by derision. But at least in dealing with them for their commodity, I would deal as merchants indeed. As merchants give no trust in the mere name of a commodity, but are apt to inquire into the reality of the article, so I would have our political merchants just ask whether the liberty they have for foreign exportation is or is not different from what they keep for their home consumption, and on this ground alone the barter must proceed. But, sir, look to what must be the policy of the French. We know how little real liberty they have at home. I will not take upon myself to judge how far in a revolutionary state those measures may or may not be necessary. I am willing to grant that if the men are entrusted with the will of the majority of France, whose desire is that France should be a republic, they must do that which is requisite to fulfil that end. But then, sir, without throwing any blame on those men, I would ask whether they would let us have more liberty in England than they possess in France. Would they leave us unimpaired the important right of the trial by jury? In short, would they leave this country to be a contrast to the violence practiced in France, and to be an eternal and marked reproach to the conduct of the Directory? No, they would be madmen if they did. Well, sir, having considered what would be their policy, we must look to another motive. We must consider the nature of their enmity. Again, I will avoid saying anything harsh upon the provocations given them. I will do nothing but regret the personalities that have been used both individually and generally. I purposely refrain from all comments, but then I say we have provoked and insulted them beyond all human patience. I will not now discuss whether we were the aggressors or not, but the more I think we were so, the more I think we indulged in personalities, the more I must give them credit for the sincerity of their revenge against this country. Will any man believe that the vengeance would be discriminating or moderate? Sir, with this view of the consequences of any successful impression on the part of the French, Unquestionably, the next consideration is what measures are necessary to ensure a successful resistance. Without asking any person to lay aside his animosity to government, who, I should trust, have too much spirit to steal an indemnity from those who arraign their conduct, I think it should be manifested throughout the country upon this point of resisting the enemy, that there's but one heart and one opinion. If I should hear persons say, we would do everything to oppose the French, but how can we do it without supporting ministers? I would say, I can't stop to discuss that point now. I will oppose the French first, and then I will talk with you upon it. If there are persons who assert that they who brought us into this situation ought to get us out of it, I should reply that I do not object to their logic, but I object to a good deal of their prudence. Because if they say that our present situation is owing to the incapacity of His Majesty's ministers, and if they wish to resist the French, they must be sure that the French will be foiled. And in that case, they do not believe in the incapacity of ministers. Or if they do believe in their incapacity, they are not sincere in wishing the French to be resisted. There are gentlemen who are decidedly averse to the French, yet they will not come with their whole zeal against them. They measure off so much of their enmity to the French against so much of their enmity to ministers. They say they feel great grievances against the present government, and yet that they think a French invasion the worst of all evils that can befall this country. If such men do not think it necessary to do their utmost to resist that evil, they have no more common sense than they who think the present to be the best of all possible governments. In God's name, if the enemy are to be resisted, let us do it effectually. Is it no part of effectual resistance that the mind of the country should be manifested and the preparations prompt? Sir, to say that we will not pledge ourselves but in the last extremity is pledging ourselves only to a modified opposition, to a diluted spirit. It is lending the left arm to our country, but saying that we reserve the right. It is taking the field with a pistol, but declining to go to the length of a musket. On these grounds it is that I wish to behold a higher zeal manifested than at present seems to pervade the country. Though I am happy to confess I see such a zeal rising. And at the same time, when I wish to see private party give way to public duty, I must also hope that the same principle will influence the conduct of government, and that whoever offers his services, in whatever rank or situation he may offer them, they shall be joyfully accepted. Services from the highest station have been offered, and from the most gallant and approved officers. Sir, I will not mark more strongly what I have alluded to, and I hope no person will find it necessary to recur to the observation. There are many matters of detail connected with this measure to which undoubtedly ministers will turn their minds. Without making large masses of idle men, there are great bodies who might produce a considerable force. To these, the attention of government should be immediately directed. It is idle to see persons asking what will become of us while they have two hulking fellows behind their coaches. There is, sir, another description of persons who, I am conscious, do not want spirit, but the idea has not occurred to them, whom I should be glad to see employed in another way. I mean those gentlemen of high rank who pass their time in foraging in fruit shops, in patrolling Bond Street and Piccadilly, previous to taking the field in Rotten Row. Sir, I am not saying that indulgence in these luxuries is to be condemned, nor will anyone suspect me, I believe, of being too rigid a censor. No man is more disposed to give credit to those persons. And I hope that in the hour of peril they will be seen at their posts and not found to be dependent emigrants. And now, sir, with every desire to see the most vigorous preparations made to resist the enemy, I must hope that the enemy not being landed, undoubtedly the desire for peace, so far from being checked, will be more manifest and eager. Sir, I have no hesitation in saying, though it may seem, but in reality does not detract from our means, that the real death blow to this country will not come from the arms of France, but from the utter impossibility, if the present scale of expense is to be persevered in, of collecting the burdens from the people. Yet, if it be necessary, we must show the enemy, for their ruin, whatever they may boast to the contrary, would infallibly follow ours, that we can, if they destroy our resources, be as desperate as they. I have said thus much in order that no preparations, however vigorous, no confidence, however great in his resources, may deter His Majesty's minister from concluding peace, except in one situation. And in that one, much as I wish for peace, yet I would have any minister, unless under circumstances which I will not allude to, beware how he treats for peace with a French army landed in this country and in arms. That would indeed break the spirit and heart of the country. We may get rid of the enemy for a week or two, but the wound would be mortal. We should break the heart of the navy forever. I'm glad to see that I need not press that point more. With regard to the principle upon which I would recommend unanimity, I hope and trust that no man will understand that I mean to recommend a jobbing, shifting union with the present administration. No, sir, no! There are sins on this subject which I will not now rehearse, but which I shall never forget. The unanimity I wish is against the French, and it is the only unanimity which can be successful. I do say that all public spirit, all confidence in public men, has been more discouraged and crushed by those who left the Whig party under the pretence of assisting the cause of religion and morality than by any men that ever lived. And here I must do the right honourable gentleman his friends justice to say that I have not discovered such a rage and eagerness for pensions and emoluments in them as in those who joined the standard of religion, morality and civil society. These, beyond all other men, should endeavour to repair the injury they have done. When, therefore, I speak of union against the French, eternal separation from His Majesty's ministers, we must have no more coalitions. The country is tired of and abhors them. Men talk of the mischief of party disputes, but I say, sir, that late party reconciliations have done more to break the spirit of the people than all the party enmity that ever existed. I think at the same time that it is not necessary, if the people are properly roused to a sense of their situation, that they should look to the lead which this or that man may give them. No man thinks higher of the head and heart, the soul and spirit of my right honourable friend than I do. He, I am sure, as much as any man, looks with abhorrence at the attempts of the enemy. That these are his sentiments, I have no doubt. But I say that looking after men does not become the spirit of the people in times like these. When I am told that in the country of 8 millions of men, enlightened as they are, and who have so long enjoyed liberty, subject now undoubtedly to restrictions, when I am told, I say, there are only one or two men who can save it, My answer is that may be the case, but that the country is not worth saving and cannot be saved. Some there are who may think the Right Honourable Gentleman opposite to me, others my Right Honourable Friend, and some that a noble Earl, for whom certainly I have great respect, are the fittest persons to save the country. But will any man tell me that there are only two or three men who can do it? I say if they do tell me so, I repeat that it is not worth being saved and cannot be saved. Sir, refer it to the people themselves. Ask them what they will do. I don't want a return of legs and arms, but give me a return of the heart and spirit of the country, and I will tell you then whether it can be conquered. Nay, if all the great men were banished from the country, I do not believe that it could be hustled out of its station and importance. There would then, I have no doubt, be found men capable of preserving it.
The text of this speech was prepared by Dr. Rachel Wilson. It was recorded and edited by Rachel Wilson and Rachel Sulich.